Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Joyce Carol Oates has explored the lives of fictional characters in more than 50 novels. 3 years ago this month, her husband of 47 years died suddenly. She struggled with her own grief, with the flood of fruit baskets that landed on her front steps, with her new identity as a widow, her journals filled with her anguish, and became her first memoir. This hour on Point, Joyce Carol Oates on her own story, a widow's story. You can join the conversation. Have you been there, dealt with that loss? What do you hear in Joyce Carol Oates' experience, in her telling? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joyce Carol Oates joins me now from Princeton, New Jersey, winner of the National Book Award and the Penn Malamute Award for Excellence in Short Fiction, one of the most prolific authors in American literary history, and since 1978, a teacher of creative writing at Princeton University. She lived not far from the school with her husband, Ray Smith. Her wrenching new book is A Widow's Story, a memoir. Joyce Carol Oates, welcome to On Point. Welcome back. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Can you just tell us what happened with Ray at the end?
Oh, well, it was so shocking, but I've received so many emails and letters since the book has come out, and there was an excerpt in the New Yorker. So I just have a sense that my experience is one of many, many, many thousands or hundreds of thousands of experiences. My husband was taken to the hospital by me. He had pneumonia, and he was being treated successfully. He was going to be discharged in a few days. And then suddenly he was stricken with a secondary infection, which is, I guess, a hospital infection.
Yeah.
And within a few hours, he died. And it was completely astonishing to me. But one of the reasons I wrote this book or put the book together was I had originally thought I would call it A Widow's Handbook.
Sort of guide to the experience.
A sort of a guide to the experience, but also as time goes by and, you know, months and now years have gone by, I see my experience as one of many, that I'm like a representative person.
We want to look at that experience, but to understand it, maybe we need to know a little bit about your relationship with Ray. Could you just take us back to how and when you met and something of the texture of those 47 years together?
Well, Ray was an editor and publisher of a small magazine called Ontario Review. And he also published books under the imprint Ontario Review Press. And we were together for almost 48 years. We met in graduate school at the University of Wisconsin a long time ago, and we were married within 3 months of meeting, and we were basically together all that time. Ray didn't read my writing. He read only my critical essays and my reviews, but he didn't read my fiction for various reasons. We were very close. People don't quite understand that you can be extremely close, almost like one person with someone, and yet that person doesn't know all of you. There are all parts of us that are secret or hidden or peripheral.
You raised that issue wondering after Ray's death whether you fully knew him. But when you look at your relationship again, so we can understand the backdrop here, how would you describe your marriage? I mean, you know a lot of marriages that you've seen outside your own over that time. How would you, I don't know, describe, compare yours to what's out there?
Well, we were each other's closest friend, and we were each other's closest companion. We were linked by our interest in literature and books, and I helped Ray with the magazine. I did a lot of reading of submissions that came in, and I worked with young writers to get their work published in the magazine as a kind of editor. We were just very close, and we went walking and running and bicycling together. We didn't have children, so perhaps that's part of the reason why we remained so close to each other.
You write about the experience of grief following his death as it comes across as almost a kind of derangement. But when you describe some of the things that you're immediately faced with, almost immediately upon his death, one quickly begins to understand that. I wonder if you'd read just a little bit for us, if you could, Joyce, from, I guess this is in the hospital, not long at all after Ray's death, and you're dealing with somebody at the desk there sort of advising you on what you, the brand new widow, need to do next.
Yes, this is very, very late at night. On a Sunday night, I was called into the hospital, but I arrived too late. There was no arrangement made for me to get into the hospital. It was locked, so I was sort of rushing around, quite frantic. And when I finally was allowed in, Ray had died. And then the widow is allowed to be in the room with the mm-hmm. the dead mm-hmm. husband for a few minutes, a sort of private time. And then I had to take his belongings and leave, and I didn't really know what to do, so I was wondering I should call a funeral home, I thought. So I went to the nurse's station, and this is mm-hmm. an excerpt. The nurse to whom I'm speaking, a stranger to me, looks up with a frown. I don't see in her face the sympathy I've seen in the faces of some others. She says, "Your husband's body will be taken down to the morgue. In the morning, you can call a funeral home to arrange to pick it up." This is so shocking to me, so stunning. It's as if the woman has reached over the counter and slapped my face. It. So quickly, Raymond has ceased being he. Now is it. I feel that I might faint. I can't allow myself to faint. I lick my lips that are horribly dry, though I can see that the nurse would far rather return to whatever she's doing at a computer than speak with me. Hesitantly, I ask if she can recommend a funeral home, and she says, with a fleeting smile, perhaps it's an exasperated smile, that she could not recommend any funeral home. Quote, "You can look them up in the Yellow Pages." The Yellow Pages? I cling to this phrase that is so commonplace, yet I seem not to know what to do next. Another time I ask if she can recommend a funeral home or if she could call one for me. Such a request, such audacity, I must be desperate. And she shakes her head, no. In the morning you can call. You have time. You should go home now. You can call a funeral home in the morning. Deliberately, it seems the woman does not call me by name. It's possible that, though the telemetry unit is not very large, she doesn't know my name and doesn't know Ray's name. It is entirely possible that she never set foot in Raymond Smith's room. Thank you. Yellow Pages. I will in the morning.
Joyce Carol Oates, reading from A Widow's Story, her new memoir, which is extremely intimate about the process of going through this. And that passage you just read, that's minutes or I don't know how long, but very, very shortly after your husband of 47 years more had died. This is such an intimate
yes.
telling. What was that time with him before you came out to the nurse's desk like, that private time that you were permitted as the new widow?
Yes, that was very precious, and I keep thinking about it quite. I think about it very often. The whole experience of some hours when I first got the telephone call and drove frantically into the hospital, it just seems going around like a tape in my head, a kind of lunatic tape that goes around and around. It wasn't really till maybe the next day that I quite understood that Ray really wasn't coming home. It always seemed, even though I'd been told that he was no longer living, it sort of seemed that maybe I didn't hear right, or maybe there was some confusion or mistake. You sort of feel that you've walked into a dream, and dreams are very fluid, and dreams change their tone. And when you have such a shock, you keep thinking, well, maybe in another few minutes this will change and it will be revealed to me that it wasn't as bad as I thought.
But it was a fact. There was no getting away from it. Did you feel then, do you feel now that you could still, this may sound silly, but maybe not, communicate with Ray when he was dead?
Well, I can imagine what he would say in many mm-hmm. circumstances. I don't hear him, and I don't communicate with him. But he had a very dry and droll sense of humor, and I could imagine many of the ludicrous things that happened to a widow. I mean, you immediately, after the grief is with you, and there's mourning, but at the same time, there's a kind of slapstick comedy of everything going wrong, everything speeded up, like a Marx Brothers movie, a sort of a version of a Kafka story done by the Marx Brothers. That's basically what it's like to be a widow in those first early weeks.
I remember my grandmother
speaking with my grandfather if she didn't know others were around, even years after his death.
Oh, that's very touching. Well, I think we all do things like that. Sometimes we talk to animals. Like mm-hmm. I have a cat, mm-hmm. and talking to an animal or a dog or a cat is a way of dealing with loneliness. And that's not that the animal exactly talks back to you, but there's some sort of communication. And talking with people who have passed into another realm of existence who are no longer living, it seems very, very natural.
How soon were you put into the category widow? You've called the memoir a widow's story. That sort of classification, did it come on you immediately?
Yes, it was sort of like iron steel trap on my ankle or something, or sort of severing my leg or my foot. Basically, it was like something extraordinary. I became Joyce Smith or Joyce Carol Smith. I had to deal with a plethora of legal documents. I went to probate court. I was taken by my dear woman friend, Jeannie Halpern. You have to have a woman friend or a close relative who will take care of you. I suppose it could be a male friend also, but it was women who took me, who drove me places and sort of took care of me.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Joyce Carol Oates about her own story and her new book, a memoir, A Widow's Story. 50 novels and more, countless essays and stories over many years. She was married for 47 years, nearly 48, to Ray Smith. 3 years ago this month, he died suddenly, and she had the experience of losing that life mate. And if we may, I'd like to take a call right here, Joyce. Dan in Gloucester, Massachusetts. Dan, you're on the air with Joyce Carol Oates.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Mrs. Smith.
Hi.
I was a student of yours at the University of Detroit in 1963 and 64.
Wow. That's wonderful.
And I remember you and your husband and your personal relationship, and it was quite wonderful at that time.
Oh, thank you.
And it was probably the only evidence of that that I saw on the campus.
Really?
What do you remember, Dan? What's the image you've got?
The strongest image is her and Ray walking across campus together. They were kind of like, they were intertwined.
What's your last name? Dan, what is your last name?
Leahy.
Leahy.
I met you a couple of times since at the Boston Public Library. I didn't
How
get
interesting.
There this year. I was down in Connecticut for the book fair.
That's so interesting.
You were a great teacher. You were my best teacher.
Oh, that's so sweet. Well, it was a really happy time in my life. I had wonderful, wonderful students. Really lovely.
It was a great time, as a time, it was a great time.
It was.
And you're here to testify, Dan, that it was love, or sure looked like it.
It sure looked like it.
Dan,
thank you.
Yeah, and she was, you could tell when people were supporting each other and different, but very connected.
Dan, I appreciate your call so much.
You
bring it right back.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, Dan. Thank you for calling. Can you look back on it now? When did you begin to be able to look back on that long life with Ray and savor it, if that's the right word? I don't know if it is, even now.
It's very hard to look back on one's own life. I think having an objective view of ourselves is extremely difficult. After Ray died, almost immediately I became very angry with myself, and I felt contemptuous of myself.
Why?
Well, I don't know. I just felt I wanted to punish myself. Almost immediately, I remember I threw away a lot of my clothes. I started cleaning my own closet. I didn't give away his clothes. I threw out my own.
I thought that was so interesting. Why yours and not his? You would think that it might be the other way. Why your own?
I just felt it was all over. My life was over. and that it was a ridiculous life and vain. And I had all these pretty clothes, and we had gone to so many places together and been happy. And it was some sort of illusion, and it was all over with. And I really wanted to punish myself. I'm glad I didn't do anything more. I mean, I think the instinct to hurt oneself may be very strong in a widow.
You didn't. It crossed your mind, though, you say, at least in a conceptual way. Why?
Well, it's very obvious if you're the person. You feel that you're completely lost and life has no meaning and that you should be with the person you've lost. I felt that to continue to live without Ray was sort of a betrayal of him, and that every day that went by I just didn't feel that I deserved to keep on living. At the same time, I had to do a lot of work that he had left behind for the magazine. So I was always involved in Ray's work. I would go into his study and stay in there for hours and work on the magazine and even make telephone calls and do things to bring out the last issue of the magazine. So I had plenty to do. But then when I was alone at night trying to sleep, I felt that I didn't really belong any longer.
We all know people who have lost life mates, spouses. You know, we've read about widows and widowers in literature, and I suppose most people who have been in a long-term relationship must have imagined it. Had you thought about what the state of losing Ray would be like one day? He was, what, half a dozen years older than you. Had you thought about it, and was it like or unlike what you had imagined?
Well, when it was time for us to drop our wills, I felt very sad. I remember crying a little as I signed my will, and I am the executrix of his estate. But it was sort of an intellectual conception. I never really realized what it would be. And I think for those people who are listening who've lost a loved one, the best analog is it's like losing an arm or a leg. Suddenly, you can't walk anymore because you don't have your leg. You know, and people say, oh, you can walk or move on, make a new life for yourself, but you don't have your leg. You know, it's like you're in a wheelchair and people are expecting you to get up and dance. And people mean well. They do mean well. But being a widow or a widower is like having an illness. You're very weak, you're very tired. You're very distracted. You can't concentrate. You are very melancholy, but you can seem to be happy. I mean, I think we all try to be good-natured when other people are around. If somebody says, how are you? I would say, fine, I'm doing well. I mean, I would never tell anybody, and I tried not to tell anybody. All this went into the memoir, though, and I thought that other widows would see, like, mirror images of themselves.
You share in here what the new correspondence, some of your email correspondence. There's one here from not long after Ray's death, within the same month, to Elaine Pagels, theologian who's also there at Princeton. You write, every so often a wave of pure freezing horror sweeps over me. You wrote to her then that Ray is gone, that I will never see him again. I have a fantasy about hurrying to the hospital room, as I've done so many times last week, and seeing him there as he'd been in the bed, sitting up and reading. It's amazing to read in the New York Times, you write, of suicide rates rising for middle-aged people. How anyone could throw a life away when life is so precious and precarious is astonishing. But that was just days after Ray's death. I guess it got more difficult as time went on.
Yes, well, Elaine Pagels lost her husband, Heinz Pagels, when she was a very young wife and a young mother. She lost him very suddenly in a mountain-climbing accident. And so Elaine and I have a bond. And she continued. I mean, she has this wonderful career. She's sunny. She's radiant. She smiles. She's generous. But, of course, her heart was broken. You know, she sort of carried on in a way that now I can see that what Elaine did to sort of reinvent herself is really noble.
One memento, contemporary kind of memento that you had of Ray was the message on your home answering machine. There's a passage in the book where you describe yourself calling that home number just to hear it. I wonder if you could read that for us, Joyce.
Yes, I didn't want to ever erase that. It was a year and a half after Ray died that I finally substituted another voice. But at first I would call the number all the time. When I was at school at the university teaching, I would call the number. Five or six rings and then a little click, and there's Ray's voice, exactly as I recall it, as it had been in all those years I'd taken the recording for granted, as if it were a permanent feature of the very landscape. "Hello. Neither Joyce nor I can come through the phone right now, but if you leave a detailed message and your phone number, we will get back to you soon. Thank you for calling." Sometimes I call this number more than once. My fingers move numbly, like fingers saying a rosary. Ray's words have become a kind of poetry, the kind of point-blank, plain-speech, heart-rending American vernacular poetry perfected by William Carlos Williams in simple columnar stanzas. Keenly I attend to the accent of Ray's syllables, the pause between words. Almost I can hear him draw breath. I can envision his facial expression as these several precious seconds out of his life of 77 years, 11 months, and 22 days is recorded. "Hello? Neither Joyce nor I can come to the phone right now, but if you leave a detailed message and your phone number, we will get back to you soon. Thank you for calling." But quietly then, I hang up. There is no message.
Joyce Carol Oates reading from A Widow's Story. Barbara in Williamsburg, Virginia is on the line. Hi, Barbara. You're on the air with Joyce Carol Oates.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi, Joyce.
Hi.
I just want to thank you. I wanted to publicly thank you for writing the book, your memoir. I just lost my husband 3 months ago.
Oh, no.
Yes, and I'm not really sure what to do, but I am reading your book.
Oh, well, my condolences.
Yes.
Three months.
So
it's
much.
So hard.
So hard. I definitely had the exact same experience. On September 3rd, they told my husband to go home with mesothelioma. He was going to die. The shock of a beautiful, beautiful close friendship that we had, a great relationship. Honestly, everybody knew we did. Had come to an end. We had to go through another journey, and I went through it with him. Anyway, I do want to thank you so much for writing, because I am reading it, and it is helping me. You know, I'm not all by myself.
Well, I hope so. Do you have children?
We do, both of us together. We had 9 children together. In other words, it was our second marriage.
And but that's wonderful. That continuity is so wonderful, and you can share the memories. See, we didn't have children, so it was just the two of us.
But, you know, we had such a relationship like yours, and it was sometimes as though we didn't have children, even though we, of course, did and love our children. But we were so into each other and so entertained, as a previous caller said, of yourself.
It's
very, very difficult. I guess I just want to reach out to you and say, now what do I do, Joyce? Because I am trying to reinvent myself, and I don't want to.
Pick that question up, Joyce. 3 months in, Barbara's still in a, you know, that's a hard place to be. But now what, she asks.
Well, 3 months in, I was completely disintegrated. I mean, I just wasn't a coherent person. I seemed all right, I think, to other people. I would go out, but when I was home alone, especially at night when I couldn't sleep, I was really quite deteriorating. And then at one point I got shingles, which is caused by stress.
Mm-hmm.
And the shingles is such a painful ailment that it was almost like a relief because it was real. I could get medication for it. I could see it. It's horrible to look at. And it has a lot of pain, but it was real, whereas the grief is invisible, and grief seems like it's psychological and emotional, and you sort of feel that you should be a little stronger. And so a physical ailment seems somehow justified.
Mm-hmm. Barbara, I hope that sharing of experience is helpful to you, and I hope your hard time passes, but not the memories. I appreciate your call. Let's get another here. Sorry, Joyce.
Oh, I just want to say for Barbara, be very careful that you sleep, that you get normal sleep, because I wasn't getting normal sleep. And be careful that you don't get shingles, because you're very susceptible to shingles at this time in your life.
Take care of yourself. Diane in Edisto Island, South Carolina. Diane, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Joyce. My husband passed away 4 years and 3 months ago, and we were also very similar to Joyce, and her husband, we married for 35 years and made children and best friends. And I just wanted to thank Joyce Carol for writing this. It means so much to me, and it's still very hard for me, even after all this time, to process what has happened and being alone. And being a widow is such a different, it's just a different life. It's the loss of identity is so traumatic. I don't know if that's a good way to put it, but her analogy of losing a leg or a limb is so correct. And it's like you have to become almost another person to get back to where you were, if you ever can get back. And
yes, that's so true.
And it's like maybe a stroke victim or somebody learning to talk again or walk again.
Wow.
And you just you encounter so many problems or just things with other people not understanding, and they can't really, you can't expect them to understand.
That's right.
They haven't been through the experience. And they also, it's just such a lonely thing. And I think a lot of friends wanted to help and want to, they mean well, like you said, but they, some people just get, they didn't want to even deal with it at all. So,
that's right.
The pain, my pain was too much for them. So, and my husband loved your work. He read all of your books. And I just wanted to thank you so much.
Well, thank you for sharing this. Yes.
Thank you, Diane.
Condolences.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Yeah. Rosalinda writes on Facebook, Joyce, she says she went through this just 6 months ago. And she says she wonders if she will ever feel alive again. People have said versions of that right here already today, you yourself. But what about that sense that fear that that's it, you're alive but not really and won't be?
Well, one of the things I wanted to write in a widow's handbook was the widow's emotions and physical state vary all the time. I remember leaving someone's house and they'd had me to dinner, I think, just to be nice to me, and just feeling I wanted to get home and kill myself, that I just couldn't bear living. I really couldn't stand another couple of hours. But then when I got in the car, I was alone. And when I drove home to my house, by the time I got home, I felt much better. It was amazing. I could be crying 1 minute and completely depressed and despairing. And then an hour later, I could have lost myself in some work or reading a book, or I'm also teaching. I was teaching at the time, so I got involved with my students. But I would say that however you feel at 1 hour, you're probably not going to feel that way, you know, 6 hours later. So basically, you will come alive again, but you can't predict it. I think it's just something that happens. I have terrible insomnia for 6 months, but then one night it went away and I was able to sleep again. And ever since that night, I could almost every night sleep normally. And for me, that was absolutely astonishing that I could sleep again.
We've just got a few seconds before a break, Joyce, but did you feel that you were supposed to feel one way or another? Did you feel guilty if you didn't feel grieving at every moment?
Well, I always thought that Ray might be watching me. I mean, I knew he wasn't, but I thought that Ray would be surprised and maybe disappointed that I was surviving, that I would go out with friends and maybe we'd be laughing together, and that was betraying him because he couldn't do that. Mm. And he's in this nether world and sort of looking on. Mm. And I just felt that if I was not being punished, that things were not quite right.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Joyce Carol Oates, author, 50 novels, countless essays and stories. Now we're talking about her own story, her first memoir, her new book, A Widow's Story. Her husband, Ray Smith, died 3 years ago this month. She's written a memoir of his death and her grieving of becoming a widow. And Joyce, I wonder if you do, we've just got time maybe for one more reading here, but on page 300, you write about people expecting widows to be strong, and then about how your very sense of yourself sometimes felt like it was drifting from you. Could you read that for us?
Yes. Of course, people want to imagine the widow strong, stronger than she is or can hope to be. It's pointless, it's just self-pity to want to explain to them that the old self is gone and the old strength, that sense of oneself that is proprioception, in the words of Oliver Sacks. Our secret sense, our sixth sense. This is a nice quote from Oliver Sacks, the disembodied lady from The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat. Mm. This sense is that continuous but unconscious sensory flow from the movable parts of our body by which their position and tone and motion are continually monitored and adjusted, but in a way which is hidden from us because it is automatic and unconscious. This is really it. This seems to be gone. This is just doesn't exist for me any longer. As one of Sacks' patients tells him in trying to describe this eerie sense of the crucial self being lost, quote, it's like the body is blind. The soul, too, can be blind, or what passes for the soul in the spiking realm of the brain. The healthy individual, the normal individual, experiences proprioception with no more awareness than he experiences oxygen when he breathes. The wounded individual, the widow, has been disembodied. She must try very hard to summon forth her lost self. Like one blowing up a large balloon every morning, obliged to blow up the large life-size balloon, the balloon that is you, a most exhausting and depressing effort, for it seems to no particular purpose other than to establish a life-size balloon to inhabit, from which in slow degrees the air will leak over the course of the next 12 hours until one can collapse into sleep, some sort of blessed oblivion. But next morning, the effort must be taken up again. Again and again. For the healthy, no particular effort is involved in being healthy. For the wounded, so much effort is involved in pretending to be healthy. The question hovers continuously at about arm's length. Why?
Joyce Carol Oates, reading from her new memoir, A Widow's Story. That image of blowing up the balloon of yourself again at great labor every day. I was interested there, though, because for you, that there were in some sense, two selves. There was Joyce Smith, the wife, then widow of Ray Smith. There was also Joyce Carol Oates, the literary figure, JCO, you call that big public figure in your memoir. Was there a difference in the way those two figures, characters, selves, lived with, responded to Ray's death?
Well, immensely. And I think what helped to save my life, apart from my wonderful friends, was that I had professional obligations. I had to teach. People told me, oh, take the whole semester off. You know, just you're exhausted. Don't try to teach and work. And don't try to go out and give lectures. I was flying around. Like 2 weeks after Ray died, I flew out to Cleveland to give a lecture. And I continued with my professional life. I wasn't going to cancel. I did think that Ray would not want me to back down and be weak and defeated. Also, Ray would not want me to disappoint people. So I wasn't going to back down. Now, if I had only been the widow, only Joyce Smith, and stayed home, I was just deteriorating. I'm not sure that I'd even be alive today because physically I was just deteriorating. I was losing weight and just was very depressed, and I couldn't see much reason to keep on living. But because of my professional responsibilities, I had to get up in the morning or at some point late in the morning. I had to get dressed. I had to be presentable, and I had to drive my car and go out into this world and sort of perform.
So who survived better, Joyce Smith or JCO? You know, the private one-time wife of Ray or the literary figure professional woman? Can you even compare?
Well, Ray had very little to do with my professional life, actually. But Joyce Smith, mm-hmm. of course, was his wife, mm-hmm. and we were very, very close friends. And I'm sure all the widows and widowers who may be listening feel the same way, that the spouse does want you to be healthy. The spouse does not really want you to die. The spouse whom you've lost wants you to remember him or her. And the act of remembering is an act of love. And so I wrote the book, the memoir, which embodies the love for Ray and presents him to people who never knew him. And then eventually the lost person wants you to move on. I think really, though it sounds corny and like a cliche, I think that a person who is magnanimous and generous in life would be the same way after death and would want you to have a new life, even sell the house and get a new house or travel or remarry. The spouse would want you to do that, even though you yourself might not think so at the time. I think this is the healthy attitude, and I think it's true.
You did remarry 12, 13 months after Ray's death. You know, there's been very nice reviews of the book. Janet Maslin, the New York Times, was critical or kind of snarky on that front, saying that, you know, when you took that voicemail off your home phone, a year and some after Ray's death, you tell us about that, but you don't tell us that you'd been courting and remarrying within that year. There's a small mention of Dr. Charles Gross, your new husband, late in the book. But how did you think about in the telling of this story, what belonged in the memoir and what didn't when it came to your own moving on?
Well, a widow's story would be about being a widow, and the story of losing one's husband is about the husband. Like remarrying would be maybe another book or another memoir. I mean, it's terribly insulting and just aesthetically wrong, you know, to have a book about one person and then have like a final chapter about somebody else. But it wasn't a secret. I mean, I was always talking about it in many, many interviews. And at the very last page of the book, a new person appears, but he's not identified except that he's a neuroscientist. Mm-hmm. But Charlie is someone who Ray would have loved. Ray just would have absolutely loved Charlie. Charlie's very funny and very smart. And he's the sort of person that Ray would have so enjoyed being friends with. I have absolutely no doubt of that.
Marika is calling from Beverly, Massachusetts. Hi, Marika. You're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Thanks. Hi, Tom. Hi, Joyce. I wanted to have a couple comments and then a question for you. My mother passed away in September from early onset Alzheimer's. And I initially was far away from her. My father and my mother lived in Chicago, and I live in Boston. And so for a long time, I was just getting emails from my dad, you know, through the whole process and as she deteriorated, and then eventually moved out there. But I was interested when I was out there that he continued to email me, even though we lived, you know, 5 minutes away, and he would just describe his feelings and what was going on. And I really came to understand just the power of writing and of communication as part of his grief process. And just listening to your stories of the, you know, being sort of crunched into this machine and this system of hospitals and medical and legal documents in the
yes.
midst of this grief, I think was something that was just baffling to all of us. And that sort of hopeless laughter at how horrendous someone just treated you and, treated your loved one.
Yes.
And it's been really interesting to see and difficult for me as a woman to see his grief process. I really resonate with, you know, what you're describing about having women friends around you and people to help you, but he doesn't really reach out as a widower.
Yes, it's
except
different.
Still through writing. And I think that's
yes.
kind of, you know, emailing friends and just he's not a talker, he's a writer, and I just wondered if you had any thoughts or advice on just the different ways that men and women process their grief and, if you've made connections with other widowers or if it's been, largely your women friends who have come around you and supported you.
Thanks, Marika.
Well, it's a good question, but I think the email phenomenon is very important because when I couldn't sleep night after night after night, I would also often be writing emails to friends and sometimes friends whom I hadn't seen for like 20 or 30 years. A lot of people started writing to me, and I had a very rich and very supportive emotional life through the emails. And I think the fact that your father's writing the emails allows him to think coherently, allows him to express himself. I could not have expressed myself in words. I couldn't talk on the telephone. I could not answer the telephone. I would just have broken down and cried. So I never answered the telephone. And it may be that way for men who would never, never talk about these things in person, but they can write about it through emails, and it's so healthy and so important.
There's a point in the book where you're thinking to yourself, you're wondering if you fully knew Ray after all those years, almost 48 years of marriage. What was that about? Why would that thought come to you after his passing?
Well, I think all relationships, including long marriages, have patterns. When we met, I, of course, was much younger and less experienced than Ray. I was 8 years younger. Mm-hmm. I was a very new graduate student at Wisconsin, and he was a PhD who was finishing up. So he knew mm-hmm. everything, and he helped me. And our roles together remained that way. Ray was older, more experienced. He was slightly stronger-willed, just slightly. He was not a bully. He was not bossy.
Stronger-willed than Joyce Carol Oates?
Oh, I'm not strong-willed at all. In our household,
you've willed a lot of creation.
No, what I used to say at our household, that first Ray was the strongest-willed, that our cat. The cat was very bossy. And then maybe another cat, that I was the fourth one in the household.
In the pecking order? Wow.
Well, many people have animals that are very bossy, and the whole household revolves around them, and I have a cat like that right now. But I always felt that because I was in this relationship to Ray, that I was never critical of him, and I was hesitant to bring up anything that he didn't want to talk about. Mm-hmm. And so many things were never spoken of. And I'm sure everyone's like that. You enter a relationship with somebody, and you never actually can break out of that relationship.
So in some sense, maybe you never pierced that authority that he had as the 8-year older spouse to fully know
him? Yes, that's true. That's true. And my new husband, Charlie Gross, said immediately, I'm not Ray. I'm a completely different person. He didn't know Ray, but he knew what I told him. He said, I'm a completely different person, and I want you to make joint decisions with me. If we buy a car, we'll buy it together. Ray bought everything. He would buy a car. He would do all the finances by himself. But Charlie insists that we both do things together. So I think I know Charlie, oddly enough, in some way more than I had known Ray. But, of course, I knew Ray very intimately in a different way.
Let's get a call from Firth, Idaho, and Vincent. Hi, Vincent. You're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
What's your story, Vincent?
Well, I lost a wife 17 years ago to breast cancer.
Sorry.
She was diagnosed for 7 years before she died, and probably for the last half of that time, we knew that she was going to die. Her and I often talked about how difficult it would be to lose somebody suddenly and not know that they were going to die, because we had so much time to express feelings and for our love to become amplified and to talk about whether I should remarry, how she felt about that and things. And we always felt like somebody who just all of a sudden their spouse was in a car wreck or mm-hmm. died of an aneurysm or an illness in the hospital, how awful that would be to just be dropped on your own all of a sudden. And as I listen to this lady's experience, that's the comparison that I feel, and I actually was grateful for that lengthy illness.
Vincent, what about your experience of grief, if I may ask, compared to what you're hearing from Joyce Carol Oates, having had all that time to, in a sense, prepare? Was the grief any less? 17 years now, but as you look back?
I often thought that was quite different, because many of the steps of grief were already completed by the time she died. In fact, when she died, there was a sense of relief of being rid of this horrible illness, you know. And then, as was mentioned, then there was also guilt. I felt guilty because I felt good that it was over with.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Vincent, I appreciate your call. I thank you for it. Reading your memoir, Joyce, there are clearly points in here where you would have given anything to have had that time with Ray.
I had fantasies that he would come home from the hospital and he'd be convalescing. It's many, many fantasies.
And you'd have time to talk it through, to talk it over.
He could sit out in the garden in the sun, and we could talk. I had all these fantasies. I would have loved to have had some years. But he was supposed to be just coming home from the hospital and getting well, so it was really shocking.
Are you, will you be the same Joyce with Ray gone? He won't be there, but what about the you that remains?
Well, I think that the widow or widower is permanently shattered. I think that we could put ourselves together the way you could paste glue, something that's been shattered. You could put the ceramic doll, you can put it together. But all the cracks are there, and the mending may be clumsy. You have to mend yourself, and you have to go out and into the world. But I think I could be shattered very easily again, that I'll really never go back to the person I was before Ray died.
Joyce Carol Oates, I want to thank you for joining us today. Sorry for everything that happened with Ray. We're glad that you've found new love, and we're grateful for your time today.
Thank you so much, Tom. It was a pleasure.
Joyce Carol Oates' new memoir is A Widow's Story. You can read an excerpt of the book at our website, On Point Radio. On Point is produced by Julie Jopp, Sam Gail Rosen, Ping Wong, Eileen Imada, Stefano Katsonas, Hillary McQuilkin, Kate Osborne, and James Ross, with help from Matt Baskin, Asad Rahim, and Dean Russell. Our senior producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thank you for joining us. This is On Point.